What's up, everyone? It's Julian. A quick note before we dive in to check out Andrew's new book, Beyond the Known, How Exploration Created the Modern World and Will Take Us to the Stars. I'm reading this book right now and I cannot put it down. And now there's an audiobook out. At first I was reading the advanced copy, but the audiobook's like listening to the podcast without myself. It's even better than the podcast. You can get this book in any bookstore in the entire planet, or you can get the audiobook on Audible. It's kind of like Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari meets Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, if you're familiar with those references. Highly recommend you check it out, especially if you're a nerd, or if you're stupid and want to learn something. Without further ado, let's get into it. Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith.
I'm Andrew Rader.
Today, we're here talking about community. Again, this is actually kind of a part three, I guess, on our rituals series that we've got going. It's been a little disjointed, but before we get too far into this, I guess we should recommend that you go back and listen to part one of Rituals with Sasha Sagan, and then if you're interested even more, you can listen to part two with David Perez, and or you can just listen to this one totally on its own. It's not necessary that you start from the beginning, because this will definitely be a very different conversation, but it's kind of on the heels of all that. Andrew and I have been talking about this community idea, and whether or not community is naturally exclusive. Do you want to expound on this idea, Andrew?
Yeah, I think this goes back to our very beginnings, and we talked about this a little bit even with John Surzan. This has almost been a recurring theme on the show where we talk about communities versus technology, communities nowadays, now that we are all interconnected with social media, that kind of thing. Even with Ramona, we talked about this in the social media episode. Communities. So communities like a gathering of people, I guess, with similar interests. And I think almost by definition, because they have similar interests, it's exclusive to those interests, or at least some kind of shared history or some kind of shared, they have a common point of cohesion, right? So it could be like you're part of the same family. Or
totally.
Historically, I think it was because we were hunter-gatherer bands. So we had our group of up to 100 people who were almost all family members, sometimes distantly related cousins and things like that, extended family. And we came across other humans in the woods and they'd be strangers. Almost every other human on Earth was a stranger and you'd come across them and they were outside your band. And so that's kind of like the original community. But nowadays we have communities over interests and all kinds of different things, like country clubs even for the wealthy and religions. I mean, Muslim and Christian faiths have over a billion people in their community. But by definition, if you're benefiting within a community, then that's not necessarily in direct competition with, but it's sort of excluding people outside that community from that benefit, right? And so are communities, in a sense, exclusive? Yes, I think they're by definition exclusive. Is it a problem? I don't know. We're going to sort of talk about the fact that everything in life is a trade-off, and even community is a trade-off as well.
Let's back up a little bit and kind of dial in what we mean by community. This all started because, you know, I mean, Andrew, you're right. We were talking about this all the way back in the day, back when we were talking to John Zerzan about how civilization started and, you know, all the problems he personally had with civilization, obviously, which that episode still remains one of my favorites. It's stressful to listen to, but it was really fun to be there for. But what we're kind of getting at when we say community, because it's kind of vague. When we were talking to Sasha Sagan a few weeks ago on Rituals Part 1 about her book, which I actually just got and I'm looking forward to tearing into, is this idea that we were talking about, would it even be possible to have a church for the irreligious? And what would that look like? And we were kind of bouncing that idea around. And then we had David Perez on the week after, I believe, and he was talking about his community that he, you know, still very much following the teachings of the Bible, but it's very open-minded and not very, like, evangelical. It's not like, that's not the point of it. We were kind of, like, picking his brain about what that looked like for him making a community like that in the Bible Belt, because he's had a lot of opposition doing that. And then I just remember talking to you after that conversation and asking the question, is community naturally exclusive? Because we were talking about this inclusive community that, like, just brings anybody in. And then we were just talking about, is it even possible to have a truly inclusive community? Because it seems like if you're going to have a reason, I think you even said this in the episode with David, if you're even going to have a community where people are going to find worthwhile to leave their house for. They almost have to have some reason to leave their house to go to this community. It has to be something that means something to them. And so therefore community would actually be exclusive naturally, because you have to have a common interest or a common goal. And I just find this idea like really frustrating because like I really want to think that, that we can find some way to have like a truly inclusive community. And I guess there's two types of inclusive. Obviously there's like inclusive in like areas of interest, and then there would be like inclusive in terms of, you know, like sexual orientation or race and things like that. And I guess like we're not really talking about the latter so much as we are talking about the former, because I think everybody agrees nowadays for the most part that, that you should be inclusive people of all types. But I guess this idea that, communities revolve around ideas and points of interest is pretty interesting to think about.
Yeah, I think it's a bit like knowledge. You can have deep knowledge or broad knowledge. So you can have a community that's really broad, that includes lots of people, but it's kind of loose. Or you can have a really deep community where people are super passionate about it. And they're passionate for a reason, because there's a particular subject or shared interest. I mean, something that defines the community that they all share, and that's what makes it a community. Therefore, just by the fact of having, like, a sub, like, say you're in an astronomy club. Well, if you don't like astronomy, what's the point of, I mean, you may be allowed to join, but it's exclusive just from the nature of you're not going to join it if you don't like astronomy. However, there is some research on this.
Research on community or astronomy?
No, it's related. It's just on exclusivity, basically. Researchers have done a number of experiments where they present kids with cookie jars. Two cookie jars filled with the exact same cookies. One cookie jar has more cookies than the other. Which one do you think that the kids prefer?
The one with more cookies.
No. The kids definitely prefer the one with fewer cookies.
What?
Yeah, because it creates a scarcity heuristic. So the kids think, oh, this cookie must be more popular because there's fewer cookies left in the jar, right? If there's less of something, people want it more.
So they only get, I'm assuming they don't get to eat the full contents of this jar. They just get to eat like one cookie or something?
Oh, yeah. They get to pick a cookie from one of the jars.
Kids, a single cookie.
Even if it's the same cookie, always prefer the cookie jar with fewer cookies. And this is exactly how kind of status works or something like that. It's exactly how, you know, if you're trying to sell a product, if you show that you have tons of product, it creates the impression that it's not very popular. If something's in rare, small supply, it's almost like supply and demand in a sense, like diamonds or something. They're expensive. The only reason that they're kind of expensive is because they're in short supply, right? But there's no kind of reason for it other than that. I guess they're shiny and pretty, but other things are pretty much equally shiny and pretty. So it's just a matter of scarcity. It makes them something perceived to be more valuable. And I think that's kind of similar in a way, because it's been shown that clubs who have rules, who have either an application process, or you have to pay to get in, or they have some kind of thing that you have to do, what do you call it with fraternities?
Like an initiation?
The initiation process. It kind of makes it seem more popular. I mean, it makes it seem more interesting and
you have to
more
prove
exclusive.
Yourself.
And therefore people, it's like a country club. People want to join it because it's hard to join, basically, right? So if you have a club or a community that's too easy to get into, it's not that interesting to people, and it's also less cohesive because it doesn't share all this, but that's what I'm concerned about. Like, you could have a church or whatever that kind of is looser and doesn't follow as many strict rules, but it's kind of the rules in a sense that do attract people, I think.
I think that's
true. What defines it, right?
Yeah. You know, the reason I'm personally interested in this topic, and I'm assuming the people listening already know this, having listened to a bunch of episodes already, is because, you know, growing up in the community I did, it was very, heavily fundamentalist, like very religious, very dogmatic, and, you know, very much based on like whether or not you were following this way of life. And as soon as I started questioning that and trying to be vulnerable with the people in that community, that I was like, openly questioning these things, but that I was still the same person, I was largely shunned from that community. And it just kind of, ever since that experience, has made me think, like, what is it that makes, you know, these communities hold together? And how is it that in some of these communities that claim to be really open and inclusive, how can they be so exclusive? You know, like they say anybody can come in, but the second you start questioning the rules, you are the scum of the earth.
Yeah, I mean, I think the rules kind of make the community. It has to be about something, right? There's a subject, there's a central idea or shared common purpose or something that makes, that defines the group. Otherwise, it's not a group.
Right.
And in a lot of religious communities, fundamentalist religious communities at least, what defines that is sort of the rules, basically, right? It's
yeah.
the religious rules you follow and a shared beliefs and that kind of thing. But it's kind of, I mean, even if you say, oh, you know, we're a Christian church, but you can come in, we welcome all. You can come in if you're Muslim, you can come in if you're atheist, you can come in if you're Jewish, come in if you're Hindu, whatever it is. Still, like, are you going to want to? And are like, what's the,
yeah.
And there's also like just peer pressure too. Like, okay, great. But how long do I keep coming and listening to this stuff that I'm not interested in? I don't believe it's silly. Like, you're making me follow these rules. Or it may not even be overt pressure. Like, you can't come in if you're gay. But I mean, maybe you hear disparaging remarks or something like that. Or you just get the sense that people aren't being as friendly with you or whatever it is. I mean, by definition, a club or a community shares common interest or purpose or background.
I think it's purpose. I think it's purpose. Because you were talking about
different. It could be different depending on what the community is. So if it's like a voluntary community where you go out and choose, but like a community includes like family where I don't know if, you know, family is just more like common background really.
Yeah, but you were talking about this hypothetical astronomy club earlier, and I'm sure stuff like that exists, but I would say that, you know, outside of like an educational system, I can't really think of many things like that exist that are super popular. Like maybe people want to go and learn about astronomy or something, but like what kind of a person's going to leave their house and spend their weekend going to an astronomy club? And I think what you said about purpose is actually kind of on the nose because it really is like, I think some kind of sense of purpose or like, something, maybe purpose isn't the right word, but it's like that idea that holds it together and makes it worth going to maybe, you know, like, because otherwise.
Well, it depends. It depends if we're talking about like a voluntary community or like your family, like which you don't have a choice about. Because there's communities where you choose to be part of or a community where you don't have any choice, you're born into, right? So, yeah.
Are you saying that volunteer would be exempt from this purpose-driven community? Because I feel like volunteering is the definition of a purpose-driven community. So
that's what I'm saying. I'm saying I'm not sure you necessarily share the same purpose with your family. So it's the opposite. I'm agreeing with you, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
I think it goes beyond that. Like there's other forms is what I'm saying. But I agree with the voluntary one. It's definitely that. Yeah, it's purpose-driven. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so a community is by definition about something. It has a reason for existing. And I think we're kind of parsing this a little bit, but there's kind of a hard exclusion and a soft exclusion, right? So the hard exclusion is you can't join unless you follow these rules. And some communities are like that and some aren't. But then a soft exclusion is we're a book club. We're going to be talking about books every week. We're going to be talking about, and the group's going to choose the books. You don't like books? Like, you're welcome to come to our club. But you won't have any fun. You know,
yeah. We're going to be reading books.
You're going to kind of self-select out of that book club pretty quickly if you hate books, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's think about this idea in terms of like countries. Like countries are kind of, you could say, I mean, a country is definitely a community, especially like, you know, the idea is that a place like America is founded on, it's like
totally.
Very heavily purpose-driven, very heavily ideas-driven, you know, so.
Yeah, I just, yeah.
So like for example, if you want to be an American, you better be patriotic, you know, you better be about the Constitution or, you know, you're going to get slammed by people who really take that stuff seriously and they'll, you know, you can't get ejected from the country, granted, from not being patriotic. Because I don't consider myself.
If you're already a citizen, you can't, but you get locked in jail. I mean, depending on what you do. But But you could be excluded from joining the club. I've just recently gone through the citizenship process for the United States, and there's a certain bar that, yeah, you have to be, I wouldn't say you have to be patriotic, like nationalist over the top, like you love the flag and you want to make love to it and that kind of thing.
You do the Pledge of Allegiance at every meal.
Right, exactly. You don't have to do that, but you do have to meet a certain bar of, yeah, patriotism, I guess. You have to meet a certain bar. So you have to swear to defend the Constitution. You have to swear to take up arms as needed against foreign adversaries. You have to swear to not pledge loyalty to any foreign countries or princes. So you have to swear to follow the rules, the laws of the United States. I mean, mostly reasonable. Yeah, absolutely. You have to meet. It is an exclusive club for sure. And they also, so it has multiple forms of exclusivity. You have to fill out an application process, which is one of the ways that clubs exclude people. And you sort of have to be invited, which is another way. You have to be vetted for sure. And like the main way that people immigrate into the United States is by invitation, meaning by family. So if your spouse is an American citizen, they can invite you to join the club. You're right.
That makes sense.
Is very, very similar. You actually have to pay a bunch of money, Susan. That's another one. There's membership dues. Well, there's actually really membership dues if you think about taxes, but there's even
taxes. I was going to say taxes, yeah.
Calculation in the first place. Yeah, for sure. So in every way, right, like it is very much like a club, right? And you don't have to do everything that the club sort of wants to do. You don't have to like football and drink beer and eat hot dogs, which I guess is one of the things Americans do, but you do have to follow certain rules. And you also can't do certain things. So you can't, for example, be a communist. You can't have ever supported, I think ever supported the Communist Party.
Right.
Or the Nazi Party. I mean, yeah, not terrible things, but still. I mean, those are terrible things, but
you want to defend yourself against it.
Right. Not terrible things that they have an exclusion against it, but still, like, you know, there definitely are rules you have to follow. So you're right. You have to meet a certain bar.
Well, it's just interesting to think about countries as clubs and, you know, what community used to look like back in, you know, before you and I were alive, and obviously we weren't alive yet, so we can only look at what we know from books and our grandparents and things like that. But in like the 50s and 60s, it seemed like, you know, community was much simpler. It seemed like if you were American, your community was pretty much your neighborhood. It was people right next door to you, across the street, you know, communities were kind of largely built on where you lived. Like, if you were religious, you went to the church in your neighborhood, most likely. And a lot of people still just do that. They just go to whatever, if they're religious, they just go to whatever church they're closest to. But it seems like now, you know, and I guess this is kind of circling back to the original question, is what should community look like now, and how can we make it as inclusive as possible while still keeping it exclusive enough to make it worth going to? Because with the internet, and this isn't a new idea, but it's worth mentioning, you know, obviously the nature of community has completely changed now. Like, you can kind of get most of your needs met on Facebook, but not all of them. Like, it's definitely not a clear replacement for getting out of your house and going and physically being in the same room with another person and maybe eating with them or, you know, just talking about stuff face to face. It's totally different than just like leaving a comment on Facebook or something or Twitter. So, you know, what I guess I'm just interested in, you know, talking about this line between how to make community inclusive enough and exclusive enough to where they both, like, you know, warrant the community existing.
Yeah, I don't think we need to think about that too much because it's sort of an evolution. It's a natural selection of communities, and they'll automatically do that for themselves. That's why religions that succeed are the ones that navigate that question really well.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
What's interesting is I think that question has sort of been answered because the churches that are stricter, I think, are better at actually holding on to their flocks because...
Totally.
Yeah, so like I think there's a strong preference for,
but a lot of that is fear-based,
more exclusive,
and I say that from experience.
Communities,
you're afraid to leave.
Well, maybe
the flock.
So, but yeah, maybe so. But that's one of the kind of the central ideas that the flock maintains, right? Like it doesn't make it good.
Yeah. That doesn't make it inclusive.
I'm not saying it makes it good. I'm saying it makes it realistic. So good is not always the same as successful. right? So I think it does, I think it is more successful if you have more exclusivity in a club. And that's actually been shown by all kinds of studies that look at like clubs that have entrances to barriers to entry. So like dues or fees that have to be paid, or application processes, or you have to be initiation or whatever it is. All these things actually contribute to more cohesive communities. But I want to get back to a point you were talking about, which is how the world has changed. And you're absolutely right. And the world has changed since like the 1950s, which I think you were talking about. It was more community-based. And now it's like online. And you can even see like people are much more interested in politics today. So Americans just, we're all part of like this national competition every 4 years these days. And everyone has an opinion now. And it's changed a lot. And also with like social media and online communities, it's so different from how it used to be neighborhoods. Right, the neighborhood has kind of died out, but if you
which
go
is
back,
crazy because
like,
we still all have neighbors that
years,
hasn't changed.
Right, but we're just not as. I guess we have the Nextdoor app, which tries to restore the neighborhood through technology, which is kind of ironic. But anyway,
we're back to being hunter gatherers. We're skeptical of our neighbors.
Yeah, but if you go back like 300 years, the nation state didn't exist. I recently read Michael Shermer's book on war, and. Actually, it's a series of lectures, which are really good. If you're interested in military history, it's a really good series of lectures by Michael Shermer. But if you go back like 300 years, most people, like 99% of people or something, never left beyond 10 miles of their house in their whole lives. So
wow.
You had like peasants in France, peasants in England, whatever it is, in Germany.
Makes
they just
sense.
Like live on a farm or in a small village or whatever. And they never go... So they have only an extremely distant connection to their king, like let alone other countries. They have no idea what's going on in the rest of the world. Like their world is very small. It's like a 10-mile radius around their house. That's their entire world for their entire life.
Right.
So the world has completely changed. And all this nationalism and the nation state, the idea that and it is an idea that a country exists. It's fictional, like it's all in our minds. There's no actual such thing as the United States. There's flags and there's like songs and stuff like that. But there's no such thing in reality.
Totally.
Right? It's just this fiction we all maintain together. Yeah. It's all just like piece of paper. And words are fiction too. So it goes, there's many layers of fiction here. Right?
totally.
But all this is really new. And actually his central idea is that
Michael Shermer, you're talking about?
Yeah, Michael Shermer, is that war has become so much more devastating because of this. Because now you can say, oh, go and fight for your country and die for your country. And that's a noble thing. And all these people just like, and it's my country against your country. Therefore, attacking civilians is perfectly reasonable because they're supporting the military. And like, so we can bomb the industrial targets because the military machine is being supported by that. So war evolved from this like tribal thing, like just the warriors fight and... back in the like 1600s, war in Europe was like gentlemanly. The two commanders would like meet before the battle and talk about what the rules are and stuff like that. And it was only like very small military forces. And you know, if you surrender before we start fighting, you can all go home and we're not going to hurt you and all that kind of stuff. And hurting civilians was like against the question and stuff like that. But then all of a sudden, because
if I can just interject before you get away from that. One of my favorite depictions of that idea you just talked about is all over Last of the Mohicans. That movie does such a good job of showing that contrast between like the diplomatic confrontation in the middle between the two leaders, and then there's just like thousands of like people ready to slaughter everything behind them, and then like they talk, and then they fight, you know, and it's like, it's crazy how much it's changed. It's so removed now.
In Last of the Mohicans, they actually cut a deal where the British were supposed to walk away safely, and the French let them in, and that was the whole idea. And actually, the French tried to uphold that, but the rules of warfare were so foreign to like the Native Americans. They're like, "What the fuck? You're just gonna let them walk away? Like, what the hell? They're here. We're trying to kill them. This is war. Like, you're trying to kill your enemy in war. Why are they just walking away with their weapons? And they're right there. Like, what are you doing? They're walking away.
Let's get them."
And that's actually based on a historical event where it really happened. The French and British made a deal, and then basically the natives attacked them because they thought it
that
was
movie's
crazy.
So good.
But, yeah, and the French tried to stop the natives, their allies, from slaughtering their enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyways, I didn't mean to derail you. You were going somewhere there, and I.
I think I was mostly finished. I think it's mostly finished. But basically, this whole idea of how community has gone from the little village, the small town village of the peasants, right? And you had your local church, your local priest, who was like the top in town. You had maybe a bailiff or a mayor. And the king was like some distant, like far off person you barely could contemplate. Maybe you had like a terrible image of the king on your coin and you're like, oh, okay, so theoretically we have a king, who knows? And it's gone from that to everyone's tuned in to like politics, and you can like now tweet at Donald Trump. You can literally just tweet him. I mean, he's probably not going to respond, but thousands of people might see that. I mean, you can, yeah. So the world has completely changed in that way, and the community's gone from this small village to the entire world. And I think now it's realistic to say we live in a community of the world.
Yeah, I think that's right. And kind of on your point you said a second ago about how it seems like so many more people are really interested in politics right now. I think that's because of how everything's being revolutionized by technology and how society and therefore communities are having to adapt to that, because we've never, like, we don't know what is, you know, what we're heading towards. Like, this technology is unprecedented. Like, how, so it's up to us to decide what all this stuff looks like going forward. And I guess that's what's interesting to me about this conversation about communities, is I think a lot of the existing communities are going to continue to be disrupted, like we've seen in the neighborhoods over the last 60 years. And I think that's going to expand to a lot of religious communities and a lot of, potentially, hopefully not, but potentially a lot of volunteer communities like we were talking about earlier. And I guess I just wonder, what is the ideal community look like in this crazy, fragmented yet interconnected world that we live in now? Like, how is it possible? What would be the most ideal version of it? And how do you make it have enough tension to where it's worth leaving your house for? Because to the point we arrived at with Sasha in the first part of this conversation, it's got to be, or was this with David? Now I'm getting mixed up between the first two. But the idea that, like, it's got to be worth, it's got to have some level of exclusivity.
Yeah, even with Facebook, it started out as an exclusive club for college students. You had to be invited by a friend, and it was it was actually really popular because it was almost like this secret at first, and you had to be invited in and that kind of thing. And that's when Facebook, people were talking about. I remember people, when Facebook first came out, they were really excited about it. And now it's just like, the only people on Facebook are basically your grandmothers trying to ask you how to like navigate through Facebook and figure out how to post post something about posting pictures of their granddaughters or whatever it is. It's totally changed and I think it's dramatically sunk in popularity. And Facebook's trying to rebrand itself as this community platform, right?
I saw that.
In fact, they right now they just have ads about like Facebook groups, and you know it's useful for that. I mean, the technology is there that if you want to keep in touch. I mean, most people these days use Facebook merely to keep in touch with people that they've lost contact with, right? So, so from that standpoint, it's useful. It's like a phone directory. It basically,
I was just gonna say, it's like a glorified Rolodex. Yeah.
Exactly. But it's trying to be this community. But I think it just kind of like, I mean, maybe it works for some people, but I think it kind of just doesn't really work that way, because it's now everyone's on it, and no one wants to be on it. The problem is people only want to be in groups that limit their membership and make like there's something special about, oh, I'm part of this group.
Yeah. Well, you know, while we're talking about Facebook as a community, it's interesting to think, you know, how notorious Facebook is for, you know, most people say they don't go on Facebook because they don't want to see political debates and things like that. And it's almost too inclusive now, like so inclusive that, like you said, our grandmas are on it and anybody can share exactly what they, you know, whatever they want politically or religiously. And that's almost too inclusive, because then, you know, people don't, I think what that shows is people haven't been wanting to use Facebook lately for those reasons. So it's, and I guess the groups, you could argue, create little sub communities that people can follow and kind of filter their community with. But I also don't think that's the answer, because filter bubbles have proven negative side effects, and I don't think filter bubbles are necessarily.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Filter bubbles aren't the answer. But in a way, you could say the filter bubbles are kind of like the rules of the club that make it worth joining. Like you were saying earlier, like a good club has rules that you have to follow. So are those like the filter bubbles? I'm wondering now, or is
I don't know. It is in a sense because it's like mob mentality. Like we shun people who don't agree with us. So. I guess to some extent, it's also peer pressure. It's online peer pressure. So I guess, to some extent.
But I guess every community is kind of a feedback loop of some kind. Like everybody's just kind of saying the same stuff.
It is. And they go through cycles maybe. So in terms of your question is how we create healthy communities, I think there's sort of two answers. One is what is economically successful. So obviously Facebook, Twitter, and these kinds of things are basically economically successful and they do it to make money. They're businesses. They're not... The community is secondary. The product is you collecting your data and showing you ads, basically, right?
Totally.
So that model is successful in our modern world with capitalism and just a lot of people who can connect to it. So it's healthy from the perspective of the people who make the community, but it may not necessarily be healthy for the people who are part of the community. But that it's sort of always been that way in a sense. If you think about it, like if you look at... Martin Luther in his rebellion against the Catholic Church was motivated by priests who would sell indulgences. So they would basically tell you, we can reduce the time that your relatives spend in purgatory or that you're going to spend in purgatory for paying us money. And who benefits from that? Well, the priests and the wealthy institution that's able to make these magnificent churches with gold.
Those poor people.
Ceilings and stuff, right? So taking advantage of it. In a sense, it's kind of like Facebook today, where they're offering a service, right? In air quotes, service in exchange for money. It doesn't come directly from you always, but comes from advertisers. So yeah, it's nothing has really changed there. So that's one form of community. But the other of success, it's one form of success. The other form of success is people need to make choices for themselves. And if you enjoy books, go to a book club. If you enjoyed astronomy, go to an astronomy club. But that, I think, means that there are niches. There are like different, by definition, there has to be little fragmented communities or whatever it is. So having this completely open community to everyone, just, I don't see how that works because we're going to have a community about everything, which is a community about nothing.
Yeah. Well, thinking about, you know, I was just, while you were saying that, I got this visual of what ancient communities must have looked like. And, you know, I think we know largely that when we were hunter-gatherers, it was the campfire. It was people in families sitting around a fire at the end of the night.
Watching the stars, the connection, astronomy club.
Yeah, talking and looking at the stars, telling stories, maybe playing some music. And I think that in most ways, it probably won't ever get more pure than that community, like, cause it's blood, it's like bloodline, it's your family. And that's like, it's a clear, natural, purpose driven, like you have an incentive to be there. And it's in your house even better. Like you don't have to go anywhere. It's just in your backyard, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's the answer. Everybody should just start a family. But
well, that sounds
also
idyllic, but do you think the kids liked it? I mean, the teenagers probably were like, oh, even in our hunter-gatherer days, they're probably like, oh, mom and dad are having that lame campfire again.
I don't know. I would actually argue that. I'm not an anthropologist, but I do think that studies have shown that we regard the elderly much, much less than ancient cultures did. Like it used to be
the source of knowledge. But now I can just Google it. I don't need to ask grandpa anymore what happened in 1965. I can just go and Google.
But what I was going to say is, I think that comes down ultimately to the parent. You know, I think that there's probably a lot of shitty, lazy parents nowadays. And I think like, even though knowledge is readily accessible today and it's not, you know, the child-parent relationship isn't so much dependent on the wisdom or the knowledge that the kid can gain from the parent. And like that respect is kind of now been disrupted a little bit. I think that a good parent can still navigate a relationship with their kid in spite of that, because there's much more to a relationship than just what you can teach someone. Like, for example, you and I have been friends now for 2 or 3 years. And like, you know, I think like we both get something out of the relationship, but I think it's also just that like we like talking, like, you know, so it's not just that we're like, you and I aren't friends because like we because of some, like, I mean, I definitely respect you and admire all the work that you've done. That's awesome. But that's not like what's hinging my relationship with you, you know? So I think, like, I think the parent thing is the same way. I think if you're not a shitty parent, your kids are going to want you in their life no matter what.
Yeah, I that's true. And obviously there is like affection and things like that. And just camaraderie and friendship, even if you sit in silence. But I do think there is something to learning that's not just like facts, obviously. So, you know, you learn perspectives. Because I think one of the things I really like about us is I learn, you're different from me. So I learn things, you know, and you have a different
view. Yeah,
totally.
Likewise.
You're very smart, but in a different way than I'm smart. So we learn kind of different things from each other. And you have different skills, which are I respect. And I think, you know, so we can mutually benefit too. So I do think it is somewhat based on learning, but it's not just like, oh, things we can Google so much, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think you touch on something that's important there. It's like there's a style of learning that is very much relational. That's not necessarily, it's not knowledge so much as it is like intuition, maybe,
or perspective, like, or yeah,
perspective. Yeah, that's a good way of putting
people
it.
Have
yeah,
different perspectives, like, and that's interesting. Yeah,
yeah,
because you may not
yeah.
have thought of something a certain way. You can look at the same, two people can look at the same data, the same information,
yeah,
and come out with different conclusions, right? And they're gonna see it in different, yeah, just based on who they are.
Totally.
I think there's some funny cartoons about this with like a cat and a dog, and they're looking at the same picture and they come out with two different things. And one's like looking at it from a dog's perspective, and one's looking at it from a cat's perspective. Something like
that. It's like that ancient idiom of a bunch of blind people touching an elephant, and one is I feel a long hose, and one's like, I feel a big tree trunk over here, and the other one's like, I feel a long rope, you know?
Totally.
And they're all touching an elephant, you know?
Yeah, totally. Everyone brings something different to the table. I think Bill Nye said this, everyone you ever meet will know something that you don't.
I think that's so true. I think that right there may be the perfect basis for the kind of community I'm talking about. If that was like the sole rule, that like you got to come knowing that everybody there is someone that no matter what they think or believe or feel, that they have something to contribute. If that was like the sole basis for a club, I wonder if that would work.
Yeah, and I think not just straight up knowledge, but just what may have a different perspective than you or whatever it is. Or yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with that Bill Nye quote. That's so good. Well, this has been really fun. I think part three concludes this talk on rituals and community. What do you think? I think we've talked about it enough.
I think it's an ongoing conversation throughout the history of humanity, and always will be. It's part of human nature. So we think
fair enough.
The book on the episodes specifically about this, but we're going to keep talking about it because it's an ongoing subject.
Totally. And like you said, this isn't the third time we've touched on this idea. We've touched on it several times throughout the podcast, but as far as like total episodes that we're going to concentrate on this idea, I think we can put it to rest. Although there's still a lot of stuff to talk about in society because things are changing. Stuff's changing. It's an exciting time to be alive. We hope you guys have enjoyed this. If you want to follow us on Twitter, I'm at Julian Was Here. Andrew is at Mars Raider. And we do these episodes every Monday. Hope to have you back next week. Next week, we are going to have Rachel Bronson on. Dr. Rachel Bronson from Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. If you don't know what that is, you might know of the Doomsday Clock. I think a lot more people are familiar with that reference. The Doomsday Clock is a product of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. I love this organization, and I'm so thrilled to have Rachel on. We're going to have a great chat about the future of disruptive tech and climate change and a bunch of things like that. So you don't want to miss it next Monday, November 25th. So a quick plug for that. And hope you enjoyed this. Hope to have you back next week.
Check out my book, Beyond the Known, and thanks for listening.
Got to get that plug in. It's so good. You got to check it out. Seriously, it is worth listening. I'm not going to just echo here aimlessly, but I really am enjoying your book, Andrew. I think it's amazing what you've done, and I wish you all the best with it. I hope it's like a New York Times number one bestseller, and not in the same way that Trump's son, his book was a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah, didn't he buy them all or something like that?
Because on the list it had an asterisk next to it or something. I wish you more success than that.
Pennsylvania. Please deliver all the books to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue basement.
We sold 1 million books. Can you believe it?